Thank you very much, and good evening. We're living, as they say, in interesting times. Many would say worrying times. Many would say exciting. In fact, the most interesting thing about these times is the glass half full and glass half empty dichotomy. I'm not sure if my dinner table was the only place in the country where both perspectives were vigorously promoted, debated, refuted, perhaps obsessively so, this summer. And I should admit right now that I have been suffering badly from a glass-half-empty view since the Brexit result. I've struggled to get my equilibrium back. Like many, I didn't see it coming, and I felt that I should. A friend, a super powerful, highly effective business leader, described it as a grief. He wandered in a daze for days, incapable of composing his thoughts, not leading his staff, not coming up really with much of a plan. Because for many people, the unthinkable actually was unthinkable. So after calm reflection, I thought it would be good this evening to consider the context that we're in now for culture and creativity, the lens through which I've divined that we will approach an examination of life post-Brexit this evening. You can't examine the influence of arts and creativity in our lives without considering the cultural context within which it exists. What is our UK culture now that we're leaving the European Union? Has it altered? And might this new world order influence our creativity and our arts? I think we can all agree that the UK remaining engaged and influential, and let's say, truthfully, powerful, as a creative and open society in a European and a global space, is more vital post-Brexit than it was before. But we didn't vote to stop being European, just to leave a dysfunctional government system. Well, up to a point, Lord Copper. I know people who've attended conferences in mainland Europe in the last few weeks where they have been made to feel just that, not influential, no longer that effective, not adding value to the debate about how to progress important agendas in Europe, and frankly, a bit of a joke. We have to recognise that there is a risk that the UK could be seen as no longer culturally significant. A solely British perspective might still hold interest, but in time will it have influence? Will it have power? And if so, why? What remains important about being culturally European? What remains important about being culturally British? The creative sector is uniquely placed to do what we do best and open up discussion, find opportunities for reflection. You can't say we're short of material right now. This provides a rich and meaty context for our work as artists. The National Theatre has just announced a heroic mass verbatim project, A Listening, to tell the story of modern Britain called Missing Conversations. And I'm sure they're not alone in thinking about this and not alone in thinking of ways to meet the challenge. The risk for the British creative sector, if we do not grasp this agenda, is that we might slowly but surely cease to be in the mind space of our fellow Brits and our fellow Europeans. And if our cultural and creative offer is not relevant in the UK, not relevant where we currently lead the world, it will not continue to be our fastest growing industry and contribute and continue to contribute over £77 billion a year to our economy. In addition, if we avert our gaze and our engagement in Europe's deep challenges, from refugees to unemployment to nationalism, we'll miss out on any influence on the big trends that impact socially on us, just as forcibly as they do our neighbours. And perhaps more importantly, we might not shed light on addressing the reasons why the majority of people in the UK voted to leave. The reality, once we get over a rising sense of panic, is that Great Britain, in or out of the EU, is deeply connected to Europe, both politically, culturally, and economically, whether we want it or not. The responsibility of the UK creative industries is to continue as we have before, perhaps with an even louder voice. Our job as artists, therefore, remains to ensure that our interests, our dialogues, our content, and our creative impact reflect our European and our rich, diverse British cultural heritage, keep all possible channels of exchange open, and maintain our European cultural connections and influence. We may have to work far harder at it, and though it pains us, we may have to address the fact that perhaps we should have said and done far more before. But it's our role now, and we must play it. In my darkest moments on the day after the Brexit vote, I not only thought that cultural isolation might slowly happen, I felt quite strongly that people who had voted for Brexit actually wanted it to happen. On reflection, I don't think that's the case. Well, not for the vast majority. So for those of us that didn't see it coming, what happened and why? To understand means accepting a couple of cold realizations about the state of UK society today. To understand, we have to accept that economic barriers have become cultural, political, and civic barriers too. If the vote was about people becoming more powerful, why did they feel powerless? And what would change that? Brexit is a wake-up call. There is something in our own midst which those with the power to change it largely ignored, or to be kinder, and I should be, found no solutions that really worked. A more self-critical view of the cultural sector alone would conclude that we have been ineffective in helping to resolve the social and cultural chasms that influenced the Brexit vote, and the challenge remains in our own sector as much as anywhere else. And that's a deep wound for us involved in the cultural and creative realm. Whole areas of life in the UK are skewered towards elites and elite-driven. Not just business, politics, media, employment, education, health, but the creative industries are part of that too. They can't and they don't exist in a vacuum. We are in an era of searching for answers and challenging the status quo, including the social challenges of access to a creative life and the creative arts, about how our society safeguards and ensures an open society, and there's no bad thing in that. The RSA is conducting an inclusive growth commission, tackling this issue head on, recognising that an inclusive and creative society is totally interdependent with an inclusive and creative economy. They go hand in hand. In addition, Matthew Taylor, our chief executive, has just been invited by this government to chair a commission and create a report on employment and equality in the UK. And we hope that will have far-reaching and influential effects. This matters, particularly at a time of a north and south divide, a feeling that we have two different worlds. How has this sense of separation, of haves and have-nots, of nations who don't care about other nations, occurred with such a stark sense of injustice in one small island? And arts and culture are no less in the spotlight on this. A new concert hall for Simon Rattle here, a garden bridge there, and okay, we can argue the proportions, but not the case that the vast amount of Arts Council funding gets gobbled up by the vortex that sucks in a large proportion of the talent and the money into the mean and dirty streets of London. We can look at these stats and we can try to reinterpret them. We can even try to deny that they're justified. But it's widely felt and it's powerfully articulated, perhaps more so now than in the Brexit vote. It exists. We will need to harness Britain's exceptional and widespread talents and creative approaches to reverse the southern drift, to reverse the desire for not just devolution, but separation. To quote the Warwick Commission on the Future of Cultural Value, which was published in 2015, the key message from this report is that the government and the cultural and creative industries need to take a united and coherent approach that guarantees equal access for everyone to a rich cultural education and the opportunity to live a creative life. There are barriers and inequalities in Britain today that prevents this from being a universal human right. This is bad for business and it is bad for society. So what should the focus of arts and culture as we move into 2017 look like? Now we're in this new world order of ours. If social divides are increasing, if fears about cohesion and anxieties about excessive immigration are on the increase, what is our role in helping to fix it? We need creative programmes to bridge the divides we are experiencing in British society, in class, in race, in religions, and between UK nations. More partnerships, more lateral thinking, more generosity to share resources and new approaches across institutions, across towns and cities, across nations and countries, across business, communities, educational institutions, and governments. If you can't live generously yourself, if you can't see how together we are stronger, how on earth can you expect it of others? A new report, REACT, has just been published, which is very encouraging, a collaboration between UWE, Bristol, Watershed, and the Universities of Bath, Bristol, Cardiff, and Exeter. The report concluded that universities can play a pivotal role in the growth of multidisciplinary partnerships. What sang out to me, though, from the report is this phrase, "But it will only work with partnerships that are based on values such as generosity and diversity, not output." We need to increase our confidence in demonstrating common cultural experiences and fostering a shared national and local identity, civic pride, a set of values we hold in common. 30 years ago, education departments were small, irrelevant sideshows, if they existed at all, in cultural organisations. Now they're mainstream, they're integrated, and they're vital. I think I can see signs already of a creeping new revolution. The nature of the connection by cultural organisations with their local communities is changing. They provide a focus and an identity. They're helping to build a renewed sense of place, of inclusion for many communities. We need to go farther and faster now. In this new landscape, the interest in connection, providing a forum, needs to expand to help citizens to link culturally to the wider world outside the UK, to understand the influences in the world that we are part of and never can be separated from. We must consider how artists help communities to harness their creativity, to unlock a greater sense of belonging, a voice, a united, a cohesive, joined up, welcoming place. To do this, we need to continue to recognise the vital importance of Britain as a creative nation. We need to maintain levels of subsidy in our culture and our cultural heritage to see them as renewable resources that can be nourished and expanded with investment. I really welcome the coming together of the Heritage Lottery Fund and the Arts Council to organise their funding based on places rather than programmes with the Great Place Scheme. This is a real opportunity for networked culture and heritage, and the RSA has been advocating this for a while, a process that is genuinely open and democratic. And I welcome the government's white paper for the same reasons. Heritage, cultural influences, and creative traditions, from culture to dance to music to story to celebration of place, are particularly powerful tools that can help us and work with us here. They are ways in to engage people with the unique qualities and traditions which make the place they live in distinct, their sense of self, their sense of belonging. These are things that can never be lost or offshored. I'm chairman of a unique organisation, 1418 Now. It's truly unique because it's only going to exist from 2014 to 2018. Its role is to commemorate the centenary of the First World War through art commissions in all art forms: dance, music, fine arts, poetry, film, games, apps, theatre, photography. When it's over, it's over. But the artworks will remain. And some of the memories and stories people tell who participated in our projects. Some things will remain in galleries, in repertoires, books, and digital media. So far, 30 million people have participated. So far, 63% of the UK population are aware of what it is that we're doing, from small and local to large scale, from touring the Sea of Poppies from the Tower, from ghost soldiers in unexpected places all around the country, a living memorial to the soldiers who lost their lives on the first day of the Battle of the Somme, to writing letters from home to the statue of the unknown soldier on Paddington Station. 25,000 people did that. To who knows what in 2018. When we began, there was skepticism about the degree to which people were interested in commemorating the First World War, and even greater skepticism about the public appetite for a creative approach to the commemoration. So I am absolutely delighted and heartwarmed to see the appetite for this kind of approach. And we will continue to explore with even greater bravery the inexorable human desire for it to be through arts and through our nation's creativity. No one else in Europe is doing this. We don't have a counterpart in Paris or Berlin. We lead the way again in our approach, in partnership and in investment. Remember the opening ceremony of the Olympic Games. We celebrated our United Kingdom, our pride in our culture and our heritage and our history, by celebrating our creativity in a mass community engagement event. A common sense of heritage, identity and place really matters. The RSA will soon update its heritage index, measuring which parts of the UK are best engaging their citizens in their own heritage assets. And it's fascinating to see the connections between this activity and other indicators of wider social and economic benefit in those areas. Heritage needs to be living. There are 46 historic battlefields which we have been given the highest order of protection under the law. Who can name them here? These battles no doubt shaped our history. But the most recent battle given this status was Sedgemoor near Bridgewater in Somerset in 1685. What if citizens had greater power to define and protect the heritage that was important to them, to their street, to their neighbourhood, to their city? Bristol has led the way here with Know Your Place, enabling its citizens to discover and contribute to the official historic records of their city through digital maps. What might become more important to recognise than an ancient battlefield site? The common thread to these examples is that connecting people to their communities is vital. It means citizens being confident in sharing between them the story of their lives and their place. It's the transformative rather than the instrumental value of the arts and the creative industries as a whole. This can't stop a war. But it can help us understand and learn why they happen. It can't stop racism or religious bigotry, but it can expose it for what it is and help us to address the causes. Alone, it won't maintain social cohesion, but it can and it does play a significant part in making our streets safer, our chances of employment higher, our economy stronger, our lives more fulfilled, engaged, and having meaning. And of course, we come back as ever to the need to maintain, no, let's say it, increase access to creative and cultural education for our young people. Creative competencies and confidence, what the RSA calls the power to create. It is every child's right, yet it is reducing when it should be increasing. We want a creative, employable, and competitive workforce. Our RSA academies provide creative opportunities and enrichment for all our students. We're also experimenting with a place-based curriculum following the terrific lead here in Bristol as part of the Heritage Schools Project, funded by Historic England and the government, and I understand it's really taking off. At its core, this is a teacher training program, and I'm particularly fond of those, because teachers need our support now more than ever to address the social and cultural challenges they face in their classrooms every day. And this week, the RSA is publishing A Place for Learning, which is putting learning at the heart of citizenship, civic identity, and community life. And it comes highly recommended. It's actually a kind of nice, easy read. And we need new learning skills for adults, like the new cross-disciplinary MA at UWE, focused simply yet brilliantly on place and the powers that shape places. These are trailblazers, and we are at a point of needing some new trails forged. There is a greater urgency now, post-Brexit, about all of these challenges, greater than there was when the Warwick Commission was published, and I'm grateful for that. And just possibly, I can find myself in a place where I'm beginning to feel a little bit less worried about the poorest communities in the UK who will lose the much-needed European money that was being invested in their roads, railways, and other vitally needed infrastructures, about the research grants and the financing of our universities and how we keep ourselves in the world's top ranking, about our freedom to travel, to study, to trade, to do business, to be employed, the effects on our investments, the pound, my pension, your pension. I won't go on, because thank goodness that's somebody else's problem to solve. Because I can more usefully spend my time thinking about how arts and culture can create a more connected world, a more joined up world, a better informed world, where our differences are celebrated and transcended, and where creativity plays its full part in making our world a better place. Maybe Brexit has given us an opportunity, a new energy to demonstrate the vitality, the effervescence of what it is that we do, how unlocking creativity contributes to society. So if, like me, you are feeling a little bit down, I want to ask you to identify and then connect with the creative trailblazers around you. They have catalytic methods of mass engagement. They have connectivity that promotes desirable values. They are a huge influence on our life in the UK. And they can, and they do, make the world a better place. These are the people who, the morning after Brexit, didn't call it a wake-up call. They had, in fact, been awake for a while, and they were wondering when the rest of us was going to catch up. It's 40 years since I was asked to vote on whether the UK should be part of the EU. I was told at the time it was a once-in-a-lifetime choice. Who knows what the next 40 years is going to bring, but the next time round, I think we better be awake. Thank you very much.
And I'm sure that she will be very happy to answer them, bearing in mind the broad range of topics she's covered. I'm sure there will be lots of questions. So, who's first? We have a roving mic here, so put your hand up. If you could say what organisation you're from, and your name, of course, as well, that would be quite helpful. So, who's first? Front row.
I'm Jerry Rhodes, Centre for Effective Intelligence. I wonder, are there any industries that are not creative, or should not be? And if so, can you name one?
No, I don't think there are any industries that are not creative. Because when I ask business leaders what they're looking for most, when the CBI asks questions of its members, what it gets back is that it really, that what people want in their organisations is is to unlock people's creativity, to all work together as part of a team, to really inspire each other to be the best company. And I was asked earlier, you know, what is it that you look for in a graduate? And I said, well, I hope I said, because I was being filmed, so you can check out whether I said it, that I think that is somebody who really wants to engage with the challenges of the world and think about how they can make their place in addressing them. And I think that's really what I mean when I'm talking about every child's right to a creative education. You know, it's incredibly important to know facts. It's incredibly important to have a broad knowledge and understanding of how the world happens. But it's also incredibly important to feel that you have some ability to be able to change it. So I think all the businesses that I've ever had anything to do with are all enormously creative. In fact, I was talking to a group of business leaders, and they said, you know, how in your organisation do you unlock creativity at the RSC? And I said, no, you don't understand. My problem is trying to stop it.
Okay, who's next?
Hello, Phil Coleman from UWE Bristol. Thank you for your frankness in your emotions post Brexit and post the vote. That's quite refreshing. You mentioned the vortex that is London in terms of funding, and I wondered your thoughts in the challenges to come in terms of where kind of the money is spent. How do you unlock that and get more of that money out to places like Bristol?
Yeah, and it's tough, isn't it? Because I think the real moment of realisation happened, as they so often do, as the gates to the opportunity for the money slammed shut in everybody's faces. So it wasn't the greatest moment. It was actually, I think, an extremely painful moment for the Arts Council, because the report that unlocked this particular story really did have some flaws in it. And the maths weren't entirely right. And of course, then everyone sort of piles in on that. But it wasn't really the point. The point was that there was truth in all of this that really did need to be addressed. I think it's going to be slow, but I think that you can't kind of put the clock back now. I think the recognition has really come. And actually, I think part of the good side of the Brexit vote is the recognition that also has played its part in a sense of a sense of separation and powerlessness for people, that there are some haves around here and there are some have-nots. I think it's going to take time. We're very lucky that we still have the lottery, and we're very lucky that still people play it, and that it is still providing a very decent amount of cash that is coming in to support the arts and the creative industries, and long may that last. But I also think that it is going to be about partnership. We can't do this alone. We have to share, and actually, as demonstrated very, very, very clearly in this city, that makes a significant difference to how every pound can go further. And I think that has also, there's been a wake-up call about that, actually. And I would say the arts have been just as bad as everybody else in thinking that, you know, invented here first is best, and that sharing it is just giving away my good ideas so that you can look better. And now there's a real realization, actually, that we could do all of this stuff together and we could all just look great. So it is going to be about sharing and stretching every pound. But I think the moment of recognition was incredibly important and not a minute too soon.
Hugh Hancock, I'm a retired soldier. Just over 90 years ago, we had a split within these islands with the creation of the Irish Free State, and politically, they have gone their own way, but I think it's fair to say that culturally we are intimately bound up, so much so that, you know, even the likes of Terry Wogan can appear and become cultural icons on this side of the water. Do you have contacts within similar organisations in Europe that can exploit the our common culture, leaving aside the more irritating aspects of politics.
Thank you. Yes, I think there is a tricky moment at the moment, and it's been described to me by quite a few people who've been travelling around Europe, which is that there is an enormous sense of rejection and anger being put towards us at the moment. A real disbelief that you know, and this is, I suppose, what I was trying to talk about in my speech, is that on one level, this was a purely bureaucratic conversation about how to run laws and money and make arrangements. And at another level, it was absolutely a demonstration of a feeling of togetherness and empathy and engagement and involvement. And I think we're going to have to spend quite some time working on that part of it. I think we're lucky in that in the creative industries, those kind of conversations flow quite quickly. We can get over our senses of rejection and get on to talking about the next project. And that's why I find things like 1418 Now so inspiring, because working with artists from all the many, many different countries that were affected and influenced by the First World War, which seems to be the one we keep coming back to because it's the hardest thing to explain, and it's so different from how war is now. It's very heartwarming to see how people really do want to come together and find a common voice. And I think we have the opportunity to transcend those barriers. I mean, it was interesting to start to think about the fact that there might once again be a border between Southern and Northern Ireland. You know, there are so many things that are potentially kind of going backwards when we thought we were going forwards. So human engagement is vital here. Forums and places where you can show that those things aren't real, and find our way around it, find our way through it, to make sure that we don't tell anybody that they're not welcome here, and we don't tell anyone that we don't want to be part of a joined-up world in the future. And I do think this gives us an opportunity to put that to the forefront now, whereas actually we'd kind of all just taken it for granted. And we must never take it for granted, ever.
Hi, Vicky. I'm Brett Sadler from the UK Leadership Academy. I'm interested in how the RSA can take a leadership role in creating more creativity and innovation within the education sector, because you mentioned that that's what employers are looking for. When we have an education system which is extremely bureaucratic and numbers-driven, so it's hard for the education system to provide the role models for students, given that environment. So how can the RSA actually engage at policy level to try to address that kind of issue?
Thank you. This is the question that comes up to Paul Matthew at every board meeting, and now you're asking me. I think we have been suffering, if I'm really honest, with a slight degree of exhaustion at the fact that I think the RSA felt that some of these kind of principal points of educational value were agreed and accepted. And as we say, every child's right. And yet it appears sometimes that you are having to run very, very hard to stand still, and even that you might have slipped back somewhat in discussion about that with government. So we're doing it in several ways. We are, obviously, we provide a forum for discussion, but I think we also provide a leadership. There was a kind of breakthrough moment, actually, at a meeting recently, where we were talking yet again about how do we prove this? How do we prove that a creative education as part of a rich and broad education is vitally important? Where's the evidence? You know, how do you take a child and I give them nothing and then you can't do this, it doesn't work, they're a human being. And actually, we agreed in this meeting that we no longer cared about this proof issue, that we were bored with having this conversation about whether or not you could prove it or not. We simply believe it as an institution, and we're going to continue to say it until the day we die. And let's just not carry on trying to reduce this to bald facts, because of course it's a whole mixture of things that comes together to describe what a creative life is and how creativity unlocks a child. Interestingly, this doesn't seem to be a problem when you're talking at primary level. It just gets a whole lot more serious after that, so you can't do the same things. So we're doing what we've always done. We are publishing reports, but we're also getting our hands dirty because we have our own academy schools. And so we're facing up to all the real challenges that our teachers are facing and our parents are facing and the boards that run those schools are facing, which is, how do you really make sure that you're giving each child an equal opportunity when we know that the world outside of the school is so unequal and unfair? And I think by rolling up our sleeves and getting our hands dirty and really understanding it, we will be able to be far more coherent and articulate as we go forward in terms of advising government. I'd love the government to pick up and ask us to do that one next after employment. That would be fantastic. But I don't know. I don't know whether they will. I think it's one of the most important issues that we face, and I think education and educationists in the UK are world leaders, and we must hang on to those things that we believe are fundamentally important to what defines a good education in the UK, because one can somehow end up so wobbled by all this kind of prove it thing that you lose the point of the principle that you actually just simply believe in because you know it to be true. So that's a rather hairy way of saying it, because it's just, I think, the only thing we can do at the moment is to keep on believing it, keep on saying it, keep on promoting it, and find every possible way to influence government thinking and to support teachers who are out there, on the coalface of the whole thing, to be able to work in environments where I think more and more they're everything to their local community. You know, they're not just a school anymore. It's a completely different kind of place. And that's another area where, with every report that we do, we can underline that fact that the educational environment doesn't sit in a vacuum from whatever else is going on within that village or town or city.
My wife has been whispering to me, make sure hands sit on your hands and don't ask any questions. but I couldn't resist. I am going to actually agree with you that creativity, it is through creativity that we innovate to find solutions to our problems. But where I kind of have difficulty is, you started up by saying culture is rooted, and you said rooted in Europe, European culture. And I was here a year ago listening to Peter Bazalgette, and exactly the same situation. The world is a bit wider than Europe. Problems that occur in the world are going to affect us that don't necessarily start off in Europe. Other parts of the world, the majority of the world, the vast majority of the world, are beginning to see what's happening in Europe and want the same. And I don't actually see this rooting ourselves in European culture to be the panacea. I think we need to become more international. Mm-hmm. By that, I don't mean that we shouldn't be part of Europe. We should be part of Europe. I'm not here talking about being in and out of Europe. What I'm saying is, in nature, in attitude, in our approach, look at the world. You know, that chaos theory, butterfly in Brazil can lead to a typhoon in India. So I'm a little bit worried that all these discussions are always about trying to influence in Europe. What about influencing the rest of the world?
I couldn't agree with you more, and I suppose I've tangled myself up in my own choice of subject, because it was in the particular context of us leaving Europe that I was talking about it. But I couldn't agree with you more. Our place and our world influences are fundamentally important to what I think is the wonderful culture of the UK. I mean, we are a wonderful mixture of world influence, and it makes us, I believe, the richest cultural country that we are. My worry is that we're tripping backwards, or have the danger of tripping backwards, into being quite a lone voice in the world. Because my worry is that if it's a good idea to step out of one group, it's potentially a good idea to step out of all groups and believe in a sort of rather ancient Britain that just needed to be listened to because we're no best and we're right. And I don't think that's what... I don't think that works anymore. I think you have to form partnerships and be part of wider groups to be able to be heard. And I don't think we'll be listened to very much on the world stage if we don't make sure that we have relationships. But it's interesting because there's equally been a conversation about the Commonwealth recently, which I'm finding rather fascinating, because my instant reaction to that was... But actually, there was quite an interesting thing about it. And I suppose it is about, where are those important partnerships? If Europe is one, where are the others? And how are we going to be in the right places? There's a wonderful musical called Hamilton, which is coming to the UK from the US. Go and see it. I've just sold a load of tickets. It's brilliant. But there is a song in there called I Want to Be in the Room Where It Happens. And it's a brilliant song about hunger for power, and where is the power? Where is the room where important decisions are going to get made about the future of the world? And are we going to be in that room? And you're right, that room is not just in Europe. It's a much bigger space than that.
Can I just make a specific comment to that? I think where the problem arises is because of this rejection, it's easy to think that there is the other extreme, which is ancient Britain. I think people in this country and elsewhere are more nuanced. They know that it's not actually getting out of the world. It's just getting out of this particular arrangement of ruling people. It's more nuanced. We shouldn't be too negative about it. We're not going back to ancient Britain.
No. I completely agree. I completely agree with you, and I think I hope that that's what I was trying to say, in a sense, was that once I'd got over that sense, I didn't think that that was what it's about. But I think we have to be careful that it doesn't become what it's about, and therefore we have to think about how we are going to be now, because that's the most important thing. We are where we are. So now how do we behave? How do we make sure that we are this porous, open place that is influenced and affected by everything that's around us? Because, my goodness me, everything around us is influencing and affecting us. But yes, I completely agree with you. I don't think that was the motivation for it. My worry was that it becomes the result.
Vicky, we also have a number of questions that have been tweeted while you've been talking. And one particular one, and I'll just ask one. How do you think business might best tap into creative thinking, ideas and insights of heritage and culture?
Sorry, how did I think business...
How does business tap into the creative thinking, the insights of heritage and culture?
By joining together, looking out in your local area, finding those cultural and heritage organisations and talking to them about why and how they are engaging with their local communities. Because they really need businesses to join in with that conversation. One of the things I found hardest of all about the Warwick Commission was actually engaging businesses in a conversation about the value of creativity and culture in the UK. And I don't think business leaders don't think that's valuable, but I think they shy away from having that conversation. And we really do need to have that conversation, because if you look at Bristol as a classic example of this, everything thrives because everything thrives. It doesn't work just because there's one thing or another. And you can take this example and look at many, many other cities across the country where commerce, the arts, education establishments, I could go on making a list, I won't, are working together and in harmony for common cause. It's a better place to live. You employ more easily, people want to come and work for you. You can attract the best teachers into your universities, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The streets are better places to walk at night. And so we need to really work together. And businesses do need to open themselves up more to this conversation and more to these influences, I would say, in the boardroom, if I'm going to be really brave, because actually it's in the boardroom where decisions get made. I had a very interesting conversation with someone, a business leader, and I said, I want to go onto a business board. That's my plan, but I can't seem to get to be invited. And they said, well, the thing is, you wouldn't really want to be there. It's very boring. Really, all we talk about is, you know, money. And I said, what on earth do you think we talked about at the board meetings at the RSC? I wished it might have been about how we might do the next Shakespearean production. It was money, 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 and money, and people and money, and how to make money, and how to employ people, and all of that. Brand, selling, our customers, it's all the same stuff. And I think we're living in a world at the moment where this business is slightly sitting outside of this. So whoever's tweeting, I'm very grateful for the question, and I would also encourage business leaders to think about the fact that there's an enormous power potential actually not that far away from you of people who are working in the creative industries, and they really have got some rather good business ideas.